wrap this up. We have the, let me see here.
Okay. There's a motorcycle.
All right, I'm going to convene the workshop here at 5:31 p.m. And we're going to have good stuff here from Joseph. As far as the count of everybody here, everything, we should have it afterwards, right?
Yes, we'll do that at the meeting. We just make sure that we have a quorum for the workshop.
I think we got that, yeah.
Yes, we do. All right, so as you can see from the agenda today, I'd like to discuss very briefly some proposed changes to our codes of ordinances, in particular dealing with commercial parking and residential zones, and which is basically heavy vehicles, and the prohibition of parking on lawns in residences. And then after that, I'd like to kind of go through the sign code that I gave you last week and really just hit the high points of any potential discussion that we have. It is my intention to take this sign code to the City Council for a workshop sometime in mid-March, and I'd also like to have a public forum where we invite businesses and citizens to come in and talk about that as well. And so with that, I'll start with the residential, the heavy parking and the parking on lawns. This stemmed from a bunch of complaints the City Council received regarding heavy vehicles in the city and then regarding people parking in the grass. And so we held a workshop, and we held a workshop at the P&Z a few months ago, but some of you weren't here for that. And then we workshopped it with the City Council last week. They asked that we bring it back to you because they had some changes they wanted to make and they just wanted to get your opinion on it. And then we are going to have a public forum more than likely in April to discuss these issues. So I'll start with heavy vehicle parking. Basically, heavy vehicles are defined in our code of ordinances a few ways, but basically it's this punch list of ores. If you're over 10,000 pounds, if you're over 18 feet in length, or if you're over, I believe it's 8 feet in height, your vehicle could be considered a heavy vehicle. So that includes semi-trucks, it includes food trucks, it includes, by that definition, it would include campers and RVs. However, they are excluded. They're specifically called out as not being considered heavy vehicles in terms of the code. And so there's a couple of reasons why we have a limitation on heavy vehicles to begin with. So for now, if you have a heavy vehicle and you want to park it at home, you can apply for a permit. You have to meet a bunch of criteria, like you have to own the vehicle, you have to be able to store it on your property where it's not interfering with sight lines and so forth. So you can't keep it at the edge of your driveway where your neighbors can't back out and, you know, they have a block view of the street and so forth. And the reason why we do have limitations is because our streets are not designed to handle the load of a heavy vehicle or of continuous heavy vehicles. So this first map on the screen is showing our approved truck routes as indicated in our code of ordinances. So the yellow lines are approved truck routes that do not allow hazardous cargo, and the pink lines, which is basically Interstate 14 and Veterans Memorial Boulevard, allow heavy vehicles and hazardous cargo. So as you can see, the vast majority of the city streets are not designed to a standard that would allow heavy vehicle parking at all times. So this is a summary of the permits that we've issued in the last 6 years for heavy vehicle parking. Before my time, people would be issued a heavy vehicle parking permit, and that meant that they could park at their house. Usually it's a semi, and they could park it there in perpetuity. But it turns out in the code it has to be renewed yearly. So technically we only have one heavy vehicle parking permit that's legal, which is the one that was issued in 2018. But since we have historically allowed these other vehicles to basically evergreen their permit, they haven't had to come in and renew their permit, we essentially have allowed those to be permitted as well. So when you add it all together, there may be about 20 or so throughout the city that are existing what we call conforming heavy vehicles. So the proposition before the council is to ban all heavy vehicle parking in residential areas, very similar to what Killeen did, except Killeen actually included a buffer of about 300 feet from residential areas. Because of the way our city is zoned, we've had this discussion many times before, you've got commercial and residential properties just immediately adjacent to each other. So we wouldn't be able to enact that one realistically, where that meant that no heavy vehicle could park at the Walmart, either Walmart, or you know, any of the other commercial businesses down 2410 or on Veterans Memorial Boulevard because of their proximity to residential structures. So we just want to keep them out of residential areas. Yes, sir.
When you define heavy vehicle, does that include the trailer?
Yes.
A trailer's not a heavy vehicle. A heavy vehicle has its own engine and that sort of thing.
Right.
Why would we even want trailers in parking lots?
Oh, in parking lots?
Or in a parking space, a driveway or whatever.
We don't. And we don't allow the trailers, even with the permit. It's only for the truck.
Yeah, okay.
So the trailers aren't allowed, period. So basically what we would do, what we're proposing is that the ordinance right now says it shall be unlawful for a person who owns or operates a heavy vehicle to park in a residential property, and then it lists them unless you've got a permit. Well, we're just going to strike that language that says unless you have a permit, and then 72.23, which goes through the entire permitting process, will also be removed. So if you do that, then you've effectively removed the ability for a heavy vehicle to park in a residential area. And so that's the that's what we've taken to the council. They have pretty much decided, or they haven't decided, but they're pretty much for this. I would say it's probably unanimous. The only issue we've got is we've had some citizens that, and why we want to have a public forum, there are some citizens that don't feel they have an option other than to park at home. And so we need to work on our education. Colleen's building a truck parking lot down Veterans Memorial Boulevard away from us. No, I'm sorry, 2410. And then we do have a truck parking on Veterans across the street from the hotel. And so I talked to the hotel owner last Tuesday, and he says that he allows anybody that stays at the hotel to park there for free, but he also allows paid parking for anybody else. And if citizens come in and want to make a deal with them, you know, he'll charge a nightly rate, or he'll make a deal and give a discounted rate for multiple stays. So he's very amenable. We also have another business that's coming in and wants to put in a heavy vehicle parking lot, so we're working with that. So there are some tools for that. There are some situations where they'll be able to park, because we felt it'd be one thing to just ban it and then they have no option, but they do have some options. And again, the big driving force for this is you've got people, semis that come in at all hours of the day, all hours of the night. They are starting and stopping their trucks, which is incredibly loud noise disturbance. Some of them do bring their trailers in, and they have refrigerated trailers, so they'll leave their engines running and idle for hours and hours at all times of day. And so we've gotten a lot of complaints from our citizens about this, so that's why we're proposing to ban them in residential areas.
Sounds good to me.
Does anybody have any questions about that?
Could you just elaborate again on the RVs and so on, because I see a number of those parked in driveways or adjacent to a street, and I made the note about a view block. Could you refresh us on?
So basically in the heavy vehicle part of the code, and it's probably A or B, I cut and paste C on there, it specifically says, after it defines what a heavy vehicle is, it says that campers and RVs are not considered a heavy vehicle. So they are allowed to park in people's driveways. They're allowed to be parked in the middle of somebody's yard if they want to, because that's the other half of this thing we're going to talk about tonight. They are not bound by the same requirements as other heavy vehicles.
Are they able to live in those RVs?
No. Okay. They're not supposed to be living in these RVs.
Guest house, anything like that?
Right, because that would be an accessory dwelling unit, and that's typically not allowed in an R1 without a conditional use permit.
Is there timing on those that are parked RVs in driveways, or are they just considered like a car?
They're considered like a car.
Why not put the buffer in like Colleen and exclude commercial, just to have both of those advantages?
What do you mean by excluding commercial?
Well, because you said the issue with putting the buffer in is because of the commercial property that is so close to residential property, but why can't we just say, you know, do the code with the 300 foot or whatever from residential, and then say, and then also in addition exclude any commercial property back up to residential?
I think in the Walmart, that would put them probably in there like the garden center going out,
right,
like where they have those Connects and stuff right now. It may be an issue where they're difficult to, you know, put a sign there or some kind of line. This is where your
I just don't see what the advantage of that would be. What purpose would that...
Well, because what they do right now is they park outside the neighborhood and then drive the car into their house.
Got you.
So if you want to eliminate that, then go ahead and do the buffer and then also, you know, fix it to where it doesn't affect Walmart or some of these situations where we have commercial property backing up.
Do you know of any particular instances where that's happening? Because the one I think of is... I'm sorry? Warriors Path?
Yeah.
The problem is that's not...
I know.
That's not our city limits.
I mean, I drive around all around Cleveland, our highest code, everywhere, and that is a common thing. It's not like it's just not in spot.
Well, that's not...
The home took his parking in.
Yeah, but it's going around.
They park on the Nolanville side, though.
Do what?
They park on the Nolanville side.
Okay, I'll bring that back to the council because that's not a bad idea. Basically, what we say is we'd use a buffer, but we would exclude business parking lots within that buffer.
Right.
So if they're there for legitimate business, then they can stay. But that would eliminate people just... Although, I'll be honest, technically, you can't park a heavy vehicle on the side of the road anyway.
Yeah.
PD would come ticket them or code enforcement. So... the issue with Warriors Path is a very special case where it's technically a county road, and because they're not impeding the flow of traffic, county doesn't have any regulations for that.
What's considered heavy? Like, what's the tonnage or the weight?
I think it was 10,000 pounds.
10,000?
There were three criteria. One was over 18 feet in length. One was over 10,000 pounds. The other one, I think, was at over 7 or 8 feet in height. And these are all ores. It doesn't have to meet all of those. So, for instance, we have another hot spot where there's limousines parked in the street.
Yeah.
Those are heavy vehicles because they exceed 18 feet. So I was able to use that to try some type of regulation on that particular individual with limited success.
But it's still parked in the driveway.
Well, because they're getting a permit for heavy vehicle parking. And so that was the other thing. I didn't get to cover that. We are going to propose... a 1 year, if so, those people that historically have parking, from the date the ordinance is adopted, they'll have a year of grandfathering before they have to move those vehicles. And the reason for that is because several of them did do modifications to their property. They poured a slab or a driveway, and I need them to be able to have utility of that property so we're not committing a taking. So if they've invested in it, you know, I did the math and figured, okay, if you were staying overnight at a, you know, if you're storing it somewhere, it was going to cost you this much a month versus how much you spent putting in that driveway. And about a year would cover that. A year is a little bit more than generous for getting a return on investment.
There's a favorite place about 50 feet off Noble Roots on Old Nolanville Road, yep. Off to the right on the south side of the road. I mean, there was the same rig parked there overnight 2 out of 3 nights on the
reserve.
And I said, wow. It was a truck entry.
Yeah, no, there's literally been 2 or 3 on Warriors Path. They actually went out and poured gravel on it and everything so they could park there. And they're just basically flaunting their knowledge of the law about what they can and cannot do. However, when we widen Warriors Path and when that subdivision comes in, that will it's a couple years off, but that will alleviate that one. But I'll look into the buffer things. I think that's a good idea. It's just, if anything, it's just more teeth. It's something else that we can get them on as far as violations concerned. So that's a great idea.
I feel like if you don't do it, you're creating a little bit of a loophole there for unusual situations, which may continue to arise as we grow, you know,
right.
Particularly on the borders of time.
Yeah. So I'll bring, you know, like I said, I'll bring that back to the council. We'll have a public forum on it. They may want to even increase the buffer beyond the 300 feet. So those are the things that we can certainly look into. All right, so if we're good with that, we'll talk about parking on residential lawns. We've allowed that historically within the city of Harker Heights since the city was founded. A lot of it has to do with the fact that there were a lot of mobile home parks that didn't have a lot of regulations, and then we had a lot of rural houses that didn't have those either. And so, currently, the way our code of ordinance is written is that if you're a commercial property, then you're required to have all-weather parking services. So in other words, you have to have a paved parking lot, and you're actually prohibited from parking in landscaped areas. So if you see a business that has cars parked in the grass, that's illegal. Let me know so I can have code enforcement out there and cite them on that. Residentially, you're required to have all-weather parking as well. But
again, the all-weather is going to be concrete or asphalt, right?
Correct.
Not rock, not aggregate, nothing like that?
No. It's got to be impervious, and I'll get to that next. But there is no prohibition of parking in landscaped areas in a residential. So I'll show you some examples where they have, and so the residential requirement is two spaces per unit. So every house has to have at least two parking spaces. So I'll show you examples where there's houses that have no parking spaces, and there's houses that have plenty of parking, but they're still parking in the grass. And so, you know, like I said, initially, you know, I felt it was because of the older parts of town and the rural parts of town as to that was going to be the big issue, but you'll see that that's not the case. Now, why do we care? Other than just the aesthetics values of that, I found this article during the summer that talks about how most of our local communities don't allow parking in the grass and they cite fire dangers. So obviously those hot catalytic converters on the bottom of the cars will very easily start a grass fire. And so there was an article from last summer that talked about that. So, you know, parking in the grass can be a nuisance. There's some real obvious issues. This person chose to park on just about every square inch of property that they have and on another lot that they own on the same street. I'm not going to name this person, but we've had several lawsuits involving multiple properties where this person has hoarded vehicles. Some of the vehicles on here were heavy vehicles. In particular, this vehicle here and this panel truck, and we were actually able to abate those under the heavy vehicle ordinance a few months ago. So we got rid of those, but the other vehicles are still there. They pose a couple of dangers. One is we get complaints from this neighbor all the time because they can't back out of their driveway and see down the street. The other is, if you think about it, what if this guy has a heart attack? How is FD going to even maneuver a stretcher to his front door? So there are some legitimate safety concerns about that, you know, other than just the aesthetics. So those are some real obvious ones. We have some that are a little more subtle. For instance, the person in the top photo is apparently rebuilding their car on their back patio, which is a code violation because you can't do heavy mechanical work in your residence. And then the other person with the limousines even has cars parked in the backyard that we didn't know about until we looked at aerial photography.
You can see where we're driving in.
So, and again, why do we care about cars parked on the grass? Well, actually, I'll get to that in a minute. So, you know, at first I was telling you maybe it's a rural thing and it's a north side of town kind of thing. Well, here's Country Trails, the neighborhood that City Hall is immediately adjacent to. All those red dots represent existing all-weather driveways. There'll be some yellow dots that represent people that have no driveways. These are based on aerial photographies. But the point is that these are the kind of things we see. We see trailers, we see boats, we see more trailers. This guy just decided to park his car right in the middle of his lawn, despite the fact that he's got a full driveway. Again, boats, this one clearly has been doing this a long time. And again, they have a rather large hammerhead driveway, and they're still parking their big truck in the grass. So, right next door to City Hall. Here we have Skipshaw, kind of a neighborhood that's been, you know, 23 phases worth of growth. Same thing, there's a heavy vehicle, boats, trailers, campers, you name it, it's in the grass. This one is not only in the grass, it's on city property. This is the creek. So like Walmart stuff's way over here.
Now, Justin, well, that one there, if you look at the curb, it's actually, he has boards bolted together out there by the curb to make it easier to go up and down behind there.
Yeah. So we're doing some trespassing. The semi and the boat in the picture there are actually in a right-of-way, I mean an easement for the power line. So I guess technically they could park there if they had a permit or something, but again, you know, they actually had to trespass their other people's property to get to that spot. And then they're leaving large ruts in the ground. So that's Skipshaw. Wildwood is an older neighborhood with actual gravel driveways or no driveways, and you see the same thing. But again, you've got a car parked right next to the house, and there is parking in the driveway there. That one's under the patio. signs in the trees. Even some of the newer duplexes that have gone in, we've got people parking RVs in the side yard.
That looks like it might be being used there.
We'll give them the benefit of the doubt and assume they're cleaning it. But yeah, so you can see that it's a problem all over the city. It's not just an old part of town and a rural part of town problem.
Yes, sir.
But why is it a nuisance? Why do we care? The first thing is public safety. As I mentioned before, there is the very distinct danger of fire. The other issue I talked about is traffic. They can block sight lines for themselves and for their neighbors. And finally, there's environmental concerns. We don't know what these vehicles are leaking into the ground, which is why I emphasize an impervious cover versus pervious. That's why we wouldn't like a gravel or rock pad, because that's still going to allow chemicals to seep through the ground. And as we all know, we have a very high water table in Harker Heights, so any chemicals are going to very quickly go into the water table here. And it's eventually going to get into the lakes or the creeks. But then we also have aesthetic reasons. Obviously, it creates a negative appearance for a neighborhood. We get complaints of reduced property values. And while that's kind of a mixed bag, I mean, there is just a perception. So, you know, Bellcat may not care, but, you know, a real estate agent's going to care. It's going to be hard to sell a house next to the guy that's got 15 cars in his front yard. And then code enforcement. It's difficult to identify junk vehicles because they're all in the grass, and as we talked about last month, they have to be seen from the street and so forth. It's difficult to maintain landscaping requirements because you've got weeds and stuff growing in between the cars. And finally, you know, it makes it real obvious when there's a lot of cars parked there that there may be some illegal home activities like a shop. You know, we've seen people. We had to have a sting and everything in Skipshaw where somebody was running a car shop out of their garage. We got multiple complaints about that, and since there were always vehicles parked out there in the grass, it was kind of hard to tell. If you have an ordinance like this, it makes it real obvious. So basically, when we looked at the surrounding region and even throughout the state, it's pretty common that parking in the grass is banned. Temple bans it, Killeen bans it, Nolanville bans it, Georgetown, and then Farmers Branch, and even Portland. So it's very common. We're the unusual side of that.
Can you tell me Nolanville bans it?
Yes.
Wow.
If that's not an incentive, you know, we are behind the curve. But what are the impacts of this? Obviously, you saw in those pictures, a lot of cars are parked in the grass, but so are trailers, boats, and RVs. So those are going to be impacted. What kind of properties are going to be impacted? The older homes that have, you know, no parking, rural homes with those big long, you know, somebody may have a quarter mile driveway, manufactured home parks. Some of the older ones don't have paved parking, and some of the older fourplexes don't have paved parking. So those are going to be impacted. And so we had our GIS analysts kind of go through and look at the city and just from aerial photography and some Google Street View and so forth, kind of guess where those problems are. The pink are the ones, and really all we can see are driveways. The pinks are the ones where they have an unimproved driveway, which means it's gravel or rock. Blue means they don't even have a driveway at all. They're probably just driving through ruts in the grass and so forth. And you can see there is a concentration on the north side of town. So we do have to take that into account when we start talking about heavy vehicle parking. I mean, I have to do parking on the grass. But, you know, and there will be some grandfathered properties, that, again, the things that we talked about, but we're going to try to put out the message of why this is important. So what the ordinance would look like is we'd actually add a brand new section to the off-street parking requirements that basically says that you can't park in landscaped areas anymore. But we do have to allow for people to pave part of their front yard or backyard even to accommodate those vehicles that they want. So we put a cap at 50% of your front yard and 25% of your backyard can be paved. That way the guy that's, you know, nobody's just going to pave their entire property and park vehicles all over it. We did decide to allow some time for the ordinance to take effect. So basically, all those grandfather properties, which are all the ones you see here, would have 6 months to register with us and tell us that they're grandfathered. So in other words, and this was at the suggestion of the city attorney, to save us some trouble, rather than us driving around and trying to guess who's grandfathered, and this is why it's important to have the social outreach, they need to come to us and say, we don't have the parking requirements, and this is our plan. And so if they register with us, then they'll have a year to come into compliance for that. So it gives them some time to save up some money and have the work done. But the idea is that we're not going to allow indefinite grandfathering, that everybody has to come into conformance. When we workshopped this with the city council, they had some other issues that they wanted us to address in the ordinance. One, we need to clearly define landscaped areas so nobody gets creative with definitions, and so that should be pretty easy. Next, that they wanted to make sure that all of the anybody that wants to do an improvement has to get a permit, and they need to have the understanding that when you start adding impervious cover, you start getting into issues of drainage. And so we may require that they have an engineer verify that their drainage meets requirements. And that notwithstanding, C, if we give you a permit, that doesn't, you don't lose any accountability if you do impose damage on your neighbor's property. So just because we issued you a permit doesn't indemnify you from any kind of civil response if you flood your neighbor because you messed up the drainage on your lot and affected their lots. Also, they want us to make sure that, because they know that the immediate response to this ordinance is going to be everybody's going to park in the street. So there are laws in effect that say you cannot obstruct a roadway to prevent cars from driving through. So right now, PD can ticket people if they're blocking the passageway. We also want to ensure that they don't block the post office, the mailboxes, so they wanted that put in there. And then again, as I talked about before, the existing non-conforming properties will have a year to come into compliance once they've registered with us and told us that they were an existing non-conforming or grandfather or what have you.
Joseph, we have here about the postal service, but what about the garbage pickup?
That's going to probably be the same thing. I guess they'll have to learn to put their garbage near their mailbox. But yes, you're right. We'll have to make sure that trash service isn't hindered. Now, the one thing that isn't in the code, and it doesn't need to be, but I just wanted to emphasize, is that we're only requiring paving for parking spaces. So those people that have gravel driveways can continue to have gravel driveways. We don't allow gravel driveways in our current code of ordinances for any new construction, but there's plenty of existing construction that has gravel driveways. So we're doing that to minimize the fiscal impact to a lot of the areas in the north where they have a gravel driveway. Again, if you look at what are the harms of parking in the grass, they have more to do with the car that's stationary and not just driving across. Secondly, you do have those rural subdivisions where somebody may have a quarter mile long driveway, and we don't want to force them to pave that entire driveway when the real issue is where they're parking their vehicles. So that's why there's nothing in the code that says you have to pave your driveway, other than the fact that it's already in the code for new construction. And then finally, there's an example of an outreach tool, like something that we would put in the water bill and, you know, post on social media and our website, talking about why we want to do it, how much of it can you improve, you know, when is it going to affect, basically answering all of those questions. So we will definitely, you know, barrage the public with that kind of thing, put ads in the paper and so forth, if this ordinance were to pass.
Is this going to include trailers, boats?
Yes.
All of it?
Yes.
Okay.
And RVs.
One of the other papers is, because it comes through here, the plaque on, people build these big, huge, you know, garages. And they put the slab down, but they end up parking their vehicles and tractors and stuff, you know, next to the building.
And not on the slab. That's, and you saw that. You saw where the guy was parked in his yard and he had an empty driveway. That's one of the things that we're aiming to eliminate.
Well, I mean, it seems like when you get a bike like that, you know, the OKM barn being put up, that should be some type of driveway going out there to it. Especially when most of them are dirt, and that's just dirt.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, with this ordinance in place, that'll cover that, but you're right, whenever we get those R1R rezoning requests, we'll emphasize that with them, that this ordinance is going to occur and that they need to make sure that they've got adequate parking for their vehicles.
I think this looks pretty good, but I think we need to really push the issue about all the chemicals, oil, everything getting down into our, literally into our drinking supply, what gets down, we jump out a tree hugger, I cut down any tree, dump chemicals all over Bell County. But we should look at that.
No, and that's incredibly relevant because TCEQ regulations have recently changed. So before, we were only responsible for what I would call water quantity. Whatever is released from your property, we have to control that when it goes into neighboring properties or into streams and so forth. Well, now there's a component for water quality. So you're also responsible for maintaining the water quality, and this would be very responsive to that. That would be beneficial for the city to have an ordinance that's helping to protect water quality in case we have an issue with TCEQ in the future. Because they look at things like that. You know, if we were to have some kind of chemical spill, you know, they would start to look at our codes and realize that we're not doing very much to protect the water quality right now.
I'm happy that we're bringing this in because I actually brought it up back then, 10 years ago, and everybody was like, oh, we're going to do that. But, you know, I mean, I didn't, living in College Station, it was a big deal back then, you know, and I think, of course, I drive around a lot, so I mean, I saw it here a lot. And I mean, I thought it was important then, I still think it's important now. You know, my only concern with it is just what we're going to do with the older properties that don't have anything at this point, because most of those are lower income. Even if you give them a year, it's going to be very difficult for them to.
Yeah, we're going to have some discussion. The other thing is a lot of those are rental properties.
Correct.
Where the property owner is out of state or out of country.
Right.
So how we enforce that is going to be something we need to discuss. You know, I guess we could always basically abate those properties and put a lien on it, like an assessment, the way we did for streets and for water improvements. You know, that's something I'll talk to the council about, but we could do that. We could just put an assessment on that and move on for those that either can't afford it or refuse to.
There are some places in town that are already tight on paved roads, but you said that it's liable to force people more to park into the street. And right now, there are a number of streets when you park on both sides, it's only one way through.
Right.
Is that going to, and I'm talking about a POV or a light pickup, will that restrict fire engines if you start getting both sides parked on?
Yes, it will, and that's something that we're going to have to look at. Basically, we're going to have to enforce that part of the code that says you cannot obstruct traffic flow through a street. And that's going to be the result.
Is that a requirement? You would always have two open lanes?
I don't.
Yeah, you should have a.
I think there, at the very least, needs to be enough for an emergency vehicle to go through. Brad,
do you happen to know? I mean, that's more of a street issue. From a fire code standpoint, what's addressed is the width of fire apparatus access roads. That does not necessarily mean a public right-of-way street. It's specifically talking about more like fire lanes on commercial properties and stuff.
Well, even like the road behind here, if we're going down the road there, fire truck, we're right back here because I think it's a private drive, they gave to us or something way back.
Are you talking about like behind Whataburger and all?
Yeah,
that's a private road, and that's a fire lane, by the way, so you're not supposed to maybe park there, but your point, you know, we can just go to Wildwood, that's the subdivision that's going to be the biggest issue. You know, it would be up to PD's discretion of whether or not they want two-way traffic or at least enough for an emergency apparatus. I can't tell you how they'll go on that, but probably the emergency apparatus.
But we already have a code red permit parking on the street, correct? So we're really just talking about supposedly the cars that are actively moving, and so they're just being parked for a short period of time.
There is no code that prevents permanent parking. Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean by permanent.
Like, a vehicle has moved in 2 or 3 years along the city street.
I don't think that, it's license and all that, and registration, inspection, what the, I don't think.
I had this discussion.
About this last
no, actually, you are correct. It's 72 hours on a public street that it can't be parked longer than that.
Oh,
so then,
all day long here.
here.
So yes, there's already an ordinance for that. Do we enforce that? No.
Okay, well, here's my other question. Are we hiring another code enforcement person just to enforce this? Because this will be a full-time job.
At this time, no, but we're looking at other alternatives. I've been working with trying to streamline the code enforcement department. One of the things I'm looking at is not necessarily hiring an officer, but hiring an administrative assistant for them. Because they spend half their time doing their paperwork. So if I can get somebody to do the paperwork and talk on the phone for them, and in conjunction with that, figure out a way where they can do all of that data out in the field, which we've just keyed in on some software that'll do that, that'll do the same thing. And I've got kind of the numbers to prove that, yet be more cost efficient, because just to be blunt, I don't have to pay an administrative assistant as much as I have to pay a professional code enforcement officer that has to maintain all of those certifications.
Well, if we had those two guys in the field with the ability to do things from their vehicle, going back and forth,
yes,
like we talked previously, if the council would approve that equipment there, that would speed the process, and then you probably have the assistant there even less time. But still, this is a lot of vehicles, a lot of roads. I think it's doable there, but those guys need more stuff. I mean, they do a lot of work, cover the city there. They need more ability to speed it up and make it.
Right. Well, it'll be a divided burden. Technically, code enforcement only covers what's in the property. So they'll be responsible for people that still park in the grass when they're not supposed to. As far as parking in the street, that'll be a PD issue. And I know PD is hiring more patrol officers, but, you know, we could hire 100 more and probably barely scratch the surface of what needs to happen. But again, that's where education is going to be the bigger key. And not just one time, but continuous education, because of the transitory nature of our citizens. We have so many that move in and out that, you know, we'll probably have something like that waiting for them when they come to set up a water account. Just, by the way, did you know, you can't park in the grass, you can't park your semi here, garage sales are free, just that kind of thing. We're going to put together a Welcome to Harker Heights pamphlet that very quickly summarizes some of the key codes, especially issues like high weeds and grass and so forth. And then anytime somebody opens up a water account, we make them sign off that they've received that.
I think they need to give that the time, and then we still need to mail something else out afterwards, because the wife may have come in.
Oh, yeah, no.
She's backpacked like that. But back to cars here, I would think that a lot of these vehicles, I mean, the one pictures you showed here look like running vehicles for the most part, but I would think there's still a lot out there parked in somebody's yard.
That are junk vehicles.
Not inspected, not plated, that we can simply get rid of.
And that gives us another tool to do that, because like I said, Calvin and Eric can't just go walk into the, technically they can, the city attorney doesn't like them doing anything without a warrant. They can't just, or they can't peek in somebody's, over their fence. But that's just another enforcement tool that we have for that type of situation where we do have things that are stuck in the grass.
Well, you're going to have to double that with boats, trailers.
Right. And we have junk boats and trailers aplenty throughout the city as well.
Another option is giving the property management companies, hey, you got to do this, because y'all drive our properties, we would tell the residents don't park in the grass, and we drive by, bail them, give them a week to move it. So you're telling all the property managers, hey, you got to tell all your residents, can't do this, can't do that. So.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that is another prong of this. One of the other things when I talked about dealing with when you set up a water account, we're also going to require that every person that sets up a water account gives us their property manager contact information, because there are so many just rent by owner, where a soldier buys a house and goes off to Germany, just rents his house out, and so we have no idea who to contact. So we're going to make that mandatory that they, and if they own their home, then the property manager is self. Fill that out and keep going. Pretty easy.
So for trailer parks that don't have concrete pavement, will they just have 1 year to take care of that, or how will that work?
Yes, they'll have a year to take care of that.
But just for a parking place, not a driveway.
That's correct. So right. if their existing driveways are still gravel, we're not going to enforce that.
They'll be grandfathered. Are they permanent?
They're already grandfathered, so yes. And there are some mobile homes that have gravel driveways or gravel internal streets. And again, what we're addressing is the harm of parking in the grass. And since they're technically not parking in those driveways.
Yeah, but they have four vehicles just like some of these R1s. It's like, how come they get to park on the grass, but you know, a guy that's got a house can't. I don't get that.
Well, no, they're going to have to park. They're going to have to make spaces for those vehicles.
Okay, that's all I'm asking.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And that's going to be two spaces per unit?
Yes. All right, if there's no further questions, we'll move to the sign code. We're going to kind of go through this pretty quickly, but we'll be looking at this over and over again. So I guess we'll just hit the high notes on this. I'm going to duck out of the PowerPoint. Oh my God, that looks terrible. All right, we'll just kind of go through this. Maybe we'll hit, you know, obviously we're not going to have time to go through it all today. I just kind of want to go through some of the major points. So first of all, the way the sign code is written is we actually have a purpose and intent. And a lot of more modern ordinances do that to help kind of clear up the gray areas. Because an ordinance can't predict everything. So by clearly indicating what the intent is, if there's any gray area, while it's not as powerful as actually saying you can't do this or you can do this, at least it gives us some guidance so that we can be consistent. And in the court of law, that's usually, you know, that's not usually, that is incredibly important, is that you're consistent and fair in your enforcement of any ordinance. So that's why that's in there. If anybody has any comments about why we care about signs, this would be the time to put those in there, or why we don't care about signs. If nobody has any comments, I'm just going to move on.
Adam is a sign hugger. He likes signs, and wants everybody to have lots of signs.
Kansas City Chiefs. I don't know if I explained this before, but we received a model sign ordinance from a law office that has a bunch of cities as clients. And they based it on the TML model sign ordinance. And it took, even though this case happened in like 2016, it took this long for somebody to be bold enough to even come up with a model sign ordinance, because they were all waiting for appellate courts or federal courts to make some kind of clarification on it. The things we talked about last time, which you guys, Commissioners Robinson and Parker, were not familiar with. So to back it up a little bit, basically there was a Supreme Court case that said, in essence, if you have to read a sign to enforce your sign code, then it's unconstitutional. So that means if you have, and our sign code clearly has sections for real estate signs, for political signs. Well, how do you know it's a real estate sign if you can't read it? Or more importantly, you shouldn't have to read it to do that. So this model sign code was designed to not care what was on the sign, not care necessarily what type of sign it is. So realistically, what we're trying to enforce is location, construction materials, and like the number of signs. Even duration gets kind of iffy because, you know, how do I know it's an election sign? You know, again, you can't regulate political signs because there may be runoffs. You know, because a lot of times their recommendation was, oh, you can have X number of extra signs, you know, between October and November and between April and June. But, you know, there are runoffs, there are special elections, and I just didn't want to deal with that. So as we get through it, I'll show you. But basically, so that's the situation, is that this is a response to a Supreme Court case in 2016 that basically said that. But there was a lot of disagreement among the people that voted for it. For one thing, can you differentiate between commercial and non-commercial? Can you differentiate between off-premise and on-premise? Because technically, I need to be able to read those signs to know that. And the Supreme Court said, yes, you can still, or not the Supreme Court, but the appellate courts said that, yes, you can still distinguish between commercial and non-commercial. And the reason why is because there are other cases that have clearly shown that freedom of speech is not uniform. And we all know that. You can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater. Historically, the Supreme Court has protected non-commercial speech higher than commercial speech. So they put limits on commercial speech. You know, that's why we don't have subliminal messaging. That's why we don't have a lot of just outrageous commercial advertising that could exist. And that's because while that is free speech, it's not as important as non-commercial speech. So based on that, we can still distinguish non-commercial versus commercial. So this is the preamble that basically says why we want to have a sign code. We talked about the geographic scope, and the reason that's in there is because in the state of Texas, we are actually legally allowed to enforce our sign code in the ETJ. It's just not very popular to do, because frankly, it's taxation without representation. They can't vote on it. And so I presume that's why many cities don't do it. The other issue is it's hard to enforce that. I mean, you have to be patrolling out the EPA all the time. So I took it out and covered our city limits with that. Then we get into definitions, and this is just taken from our code ordinances and from the model code ordinances, and this is, again, just all boilerplate. I will say one of the things that we are going to change at the suggestion of the building official is that this code calls two different bodies to judge signs, the sign administrator and the building official. And the reason why is because the model ordinance says sign administrator, and our existing code says building official. And the idea is I kind of married them and wasn't consistent about that. So the building official recommended we just have one, so I volunteered him to do it. So that will change. So there will be, if there's a definition for sign administrator, it's going to say the building official or his designee. So he'll be in charge of all of that. So these are all of our definitions. If there's any questions at any time, just go ahead and stop me. There's some boilerplate language on prohibited signs, where basically we just start out and say, these kind of signs are just not allowed at any time. You know, I think I highlighted on here signs that blink, fluctuate, or move, and also blocking light trespass, so that's what I added. This was, the non-highlighted was the original. I added the highlighted because I really like the idea of blocking light trespass. Anyway, so this kind of goes through, we do specifically call out balloon and inflatable signs as being banned. It also had feather flags, but because I had to allow them in the previous code amendment, I took that out as a prohibited sign here. I personally do not like feather flags, but again, I can't legislate my taste over everybody else's. This is a democracy, so, you know, so for now, feather flags are allowed. Okay, authorized signs are the signs that are allowed in general, you know, government signs, traffic control. And again, how do you know it's government sign without reading it? Because a government entity placed that sign. So it's not necessarily the content of the sign, it's who put it in there. Signs required by this ordinance are authorized, obviously. Signs displayed on trucks and so forth are allowed as long as they don't exceed 32 square feet. You're going to see 32 square feet all over the place. I do not honestly know where that number came from, but it was in the model ordinance, and it was in our original code ordinances, so I suspect there's some kind of industry standard.
Four by eight.
32 feet can get broken down very easily into multiple sign sizes, so that I just left that 32 square feet throughout.
On this, as far as the trucks, buses, trailers, and all that, having less than 32 square feet, some of those, if they're like a partial wrap, they have a logo here, a phone number over there. It'd be difficult to measure. Are these people going to bring in with an invoice as far as...
You know, to be perfectly honest, we're probably not even going to release that. But it's in there as yet another enforcement tool. What we're going to care about, I'm just going to tell you right now, what we're going to care about as a department is going to be the quality of the signs. So we're going to drive around. If the sign looks terrible, then we're going to stop and investigate. Do they have a permit if necessary? Is the sign up to date? Is the sign material, you know, do they exceed the number of signs they can have? So it's going to be something that catches our eye. But as I discussed before, we don't necessarily have the manpower to police it that, with that much scrutiny. For me, the big key here is that it has to be operated as a motor vehicle. So in other words, it specifically says you can't just throw a junk vehicle, paint your name on it, and say it's a sign, which we've seen in other municipalities. Whether or not we get sued, I think they won one and they lost one in that scenario. So it's kind of open interpretation. But since our code specifically calls that out as a banned sign, I think we have a stronger footing if we didn't have that in there.
So let me ask you this about that. I think I personally have five or six vehicles that have greater than 32 square feet on the side of them.
Okay.
Right. Or,
Tiffany?
Pretty sure I'm not going along. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of commercial vehicles that are... The transit van has greater than 4x8 on the side of it. So how are you going to enforce that? I mean, what do you, this would be for the city as a whole. They're parked in the city.
I thought there was somewhere in here where they can get a permit for it. Aren't these just the allowables without permit?
Right. Oh, cost what? I apologize. No, this says signs attached to vehicles. So this is for people that have like mobile signs. So wraps are not
not car wraps.
So wrap is not gonna count.
So we're okay. Your Spiller custom hitches or whatever on the side of your truck doesn't count. It's if you attach a sign. So for instance, just down the street, the guy with the shaved eyes that has the big feather flags attached to it would be bound by that 32 square feet for those feather flags. Okay. But he can wrap his whole car and make it look like a snow cone if he wants to. So we're covered. That's right. It's attached to vehicles. That would also include banners. So the art school that has a banner on the side of it has to conform to 32 square feet. But if they just paint the vehicle, it does not. So we should be okay with that.
That language is displayed on there to me. I mean, you could.
Well, maybe we should say attached.
Something.
Okay, if you wonder if you can like just do that.
We'll highlight it. So I know. So that would, and I can clean that up later, but basically the gist is a physical sign attached to the vehicle versus decoration of the vehicle.
Gotcha. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. Here we have a section that says that we can hold the lessor just as responsible as the property owner, which is really good because a lot of times we play that chicken and egg thing of who we go after. Well, who wants to go after whoever it takes to get the job done.
I like that.
And then start out with things that don't require a sign permit. So basically, you don't need a permit to do minor repairs on an existing sign. You don't need a permit to change copy on a sign. So if you're changing it from Clem McKeskis to when you become a Black Ink or Black Meg, don't need a permit to do that.
Now it's a chicken
shell. Now it's the crab
or something. Crab.
Boil or whatever it is. You don't need a permit to do all of that. Let's see, what are the big ones there? Any sign inside a building doesn't need a permit. One sign per entrance door in a non-residential district shall be allowed. Basically, that's to basically name your business on the door. Doesn't need a permit. The other one I highlighted is if the sign is damaged, you know, you can immediately repair it and then go back and get a permit from the building official if there was some kind of emergency, like, you know, a big giant wall or a big giant marquee sign is like half hanging off the building. Obviously, don't get a permit, go fix it, and come talk to us.
The only thing that I just think about and maybe it might not be an issue, but what about like businesses that display like 30-06, 30-07 signs in addition to their business sign, like on the entrance? So how does that fall in there?
That's what those signs were that are attached to your door or by your door. Okay. So not no permit given, no concern. That also includes the ADA required signs, right, or the no trespassers, no solicitors, that kind of thing. It's all put under that. All right. So then what we did is we created this section on the design of the sign. As I talked about, those are things you cover is what materials and so forth. So that's its own section. Instead of mixing it in and saying, okay, here's residential, and then here's design, and here's commercial, we just put all in one area so it's easier to get to. One of the things in the language is architectural harmony. The signs should be in architectural harmony. I highlighted that because I don't like it. Mostly because that's an incredibly subjective term. And that's just one of those things that I definitely want your feedback on. Is there a better way to say that?
I thought it sounded pretty good.
Okay. But, you know, the idea is that we want it to be consistent. So, in other words, you've got a strip center and they have these nice signs, and then somebody comes in and just throws in like a big pipe metal sign that doesn't match the rest of the property. That's the kind of thing that we would try to prevent.
Well, the architectural harmony there, I mean, that covers where it flows right through there.
But again, it's subjective. I guess
harmony is something that is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
It's a nebulous term. Harmony You know, well, you can sing off key and both people think they're in harmony. That's right.
Now, I'll tell you,
harmony is a bad word.
What we've seen in the past is we've had
how about just blends in with the surrounding buildings?
That's
blends in is more objective.
It still requires them, two different people might have a different sort of opinion on this.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the reason why I like the word architectural harmony is that we've had a situation similarly where somebody wanted to do something differently with the landscaping, and he actually got an architect to come in and write essentially a white paper saying why this was still, why it counted. In other words, why I couldn't tell them they couldn't do it. And I said, you know, that's a great point. And we let them do it. And so that's kind of how I would see that, is if I told somebody that's not an architectural harmony, so I'm not going to approve it, their defense would be to get an architect to write up something that says, yes, it is. This is why it needs, you know.
Yeah, can we look at the citizen academic aspect?
Yes.
Would that say architecturally pleasing?
I think
the architectural part's kind of
even way more subjective to say pleasing.
I just I deal with architectural committees and stuff, and that's why I like kind of like the way it sounded. But I see what you are saying. So,
well, we'll give that some more thought. When we talk about it again, everybody think about this. Let's highlight that when we think about a better way to basically say it needs to match what's there. Again, we talked about signs inside buildings, have some regulation.
I got a question with signs. When a business goes out, that sign will sit there for months and not years until somebody comes in there. Is there something we can do to change that?
I thought about that. The issue is that that's a cost that's incurred upon the property owner that's not necessarily in a position to do that. One of the things we talked about.
You could put it on the business leaving, though.
Well, how do you go after? They went bankrupt. You can't sell somebody's blood from a stone.
I thought we went over this previously, though. I thought we made something up for that. Years back or 3 years back, because all from that Black Meg sign, or no, McKeska's sign.
Yeah, it was McKeska's. I need to go back through here because there may actually be language on
that. I thought there was something there.
Go back through it. But one of the things that we thought about was that maybe businesses need to have a sign deposit, like you do the first and last month's rent, so that if they leave and they don't change their sign, but it's a cost thing and then it's just a convenience thing. It's, you know, you got to hire the guy to come out, put a white board on where the sign was, and then when you get a new tenant, then they got to come out again and do it. Yeah. So theoretically, there should be a pretty swift transfer, but I will put that in there because that's one of the things we talked about was maybe you can do a sign deposit. I mean, I'm not going to tell a business how to run itself, but that would be a suggestion.
Well, yeah, because sometimes you'll see a billboard that has 20 businesses. And there might only be 15 businesses in that plaza, but they're all full. So you can't even read what business you're trying to get to, and then it's becoming a traffic hazard because you just read 10 businesses that aren't even there.
Yeah, people that say, hey, they're driving by, they want to pull into a McKeska's Neat Market.
And it's not there.
Yeah. Start driving through the area, or you have people, I'm going to get to McKeska's, this guy just robbed me, please come help. And
there's
they're
no
like, where's McKeska's?
Right, and that's simple,
you call the wrong place.
And that's an incredibly legitimate reason to have that kind of rule in there, and I've seen that in other sign codes. Mm-hmm. I honestly need to go back because it may be in this language. If not, we'll look at adding that because that's a good point. And that's the other thing. You're driving down I-14. Oh, there's Glen McKeska's.
Yeah. There you go.
And then you're angry because it wasn't there, and then you never want to come back to Arkansas because we're a bunch of liars. So,
I think that we need to get a decent place.
Yes.
Because most of these are tenants, and I'm sure the building owners do not want to have to go out there and do it all the time.
Yeah,
well, that would definitely.
Yes.
More
than that?
Yeah, for commercial.
Oh, man.
How many days do you think?
90 days.
No, I would do more than 90. I would do at least 6 months to be able to get for the tenant to move out and get a new tenant in and get them established.
They can bag those signs.
Wow, you're nice because I was going to recommend 30 days. Okay.
Yeah.
So well, you're saying 180 days?
Well, I guess the thing about it is, and I'm not saying we have to compare it to others, but the more restrictive we are, the more people go to the council. So I don't want to be so harsh because we want commercial business here. And I'm not, and I mean, I get both sides of it, but I'm just saying, let's be a little gracious with it instead of, we don't do it in 30 days.
Well, 6 months goes quickly in the big picture. There's the off of Indian Trail, there was a 5 and 10 cent store went in called Smart Spenders. And the sign was Smart and then Spenders on the big multiple thing sign. It went out of business within a year or two. The sign remained for years and years and years.
And I think that's the point, is we want to go after those guys more. So 180 days.
I'd go 6 months.
All right. Yeah. We'll put it in there that way. And you know,
I'll tell you, 6 months and one day.
We'll add that language to that. So we're going to require that signs, the obsolete signs, be updated within 180 days.
I swear we did that 3 years ago. Or
we did not, but we've talked about it.
Yeah, okay.
No, in fact, we started all of that and then got the monkey wrench of the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, years ago, on Business 190 in Harker Heights, there's lots of dead businesses, and some of the signs have been there for years.
Yes.
And they were faded. I remember the conversation. They were faded, illegible, but they were still there. They were defunct, they were decrepit. And then I think we just moved on and improved it.
That sign was up for
decades. 20 years.
And that's a good point, because then that gives us another tool. So first of all, we can enforce the fact that the sign's not well maintained, and then secondly, we can say the sign's been obsolete longer than 180 days. So that's another enforcement tool that we could use when we have to act. Okay, so that being said, I think maybe we've reached a good stopping point, and we can I'll make these tweaks and bring it back, and then we'll keep going through the code. Maybe we'll finish this section real quick, because this is all just the requirements. Obviously, you can't be in the right of way, you can't be on utilities, you have to have that intersection visual clearance, you can't block people's driveways, or if you have a sign by driveway, it can't be more than 3 feet high, because you do have to have your drive through and your here kind of signs. You just can't block that sight triangle. Can't have reflective glare producing services. This is the big one. Electronic signs, I've done a lot of research, and our current code says that you have to have the copy up for like 60 seconds. After doing research, talking to some sign people, 10 seconds is not distracting. That's enough time to read a sign and let them change messages. But they also want to be able to animate, and I want to talk, you know, we need to limit that. You know, what I don't want is to have the Dennis Egan Kia sign where they're literally playing commercials with dancing hamsters. You know, a commercial you would see on TV is playing on your electronic billboard. But what I've been, you know, with the dental office down the street, just wants to be able to have some kind of nice transition from the lady with the braces to the spaceships or whatever. You know, they don't want just to start either, you know, we don't want the full animation, they don't want just plain, you know, screenshots that change. There needs to be some kind of middle ground. So we're working on that. If anybody can think of any language that says limited animation but isn't subjective, that would be awesome. So some homework for next time. And then we're dropping the whole nit standard that was put out when we last did a sign code update, because it's almost impossible to measure nits. We're just going to measure foot candles and be done with it, with this weird equation. It's actually not that hard to deal with. And of course, signs can't resemble warning signs or emergency signs. You know, you can't sit there and have the police lights in your window, that kind of thing. And then no light trespass, no moving parts.
Go back just a minute, Joseph, on that light. I mean, all floodlights shall be shielded. I mean, some of this is really important when you drive around at night.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's. Shielding is a non-operative word on an awful lot of outdoor lighting.
Right.
It needs to be.
Yeah, that's why that's in there. And, you know, I can't emphasize that enough, and especially in conjunction with, we haven't talked about this, but, you know, we just completed a joint land use study with Fort Hood, the idea being to make sure that Fort Hood remains a viable option in case there's a, you know, a rash in the area. And one of their recommendations is reducing nighttime light pollution. They actually encourage dark skies type of ordinance. So we're looking into that, you know, because we do a lot of night ops. And so that's part of that. Let's see. No moving parts, no posting in public places, no posting on private premises without permission of the owner. So that pretty much covers the sign, you know, requirements or what you can't do. So I think that's a good stopping point.
I was just going to talk about the flags, banners, and pennants, but I can get with you afterwards.
All right, Joseph, you're good?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, 5:35 p.m., Tiffany, we're closing the 6:35, stopping the workshop right there. Thank you, guys. Okay, now, you want to do a quick break in between, or do you keep going?
Whatever you want to do.
Does anybody have to use a bathroom or anything like that?
No, not anymore.
All right. That was kind of scary.
I'm going to get up and walk. I'm sorry.
Okay, we're going to start here. 6:36 p.m., I call to order the regular meeting of the Harper Heights Planning and Zoning Commission for February 27th, 2019. We will start with an invocation and pledge of allegiance. Commissioner Robinson will be doing the invocation, and Commissioner Parker will lead us in the pledge of allegiance. Please join us if you'd like.
Our Father, thank you for the opportunity to publicly be about the city's business that affects each one of us in many different ways, but it's an open sharing and just a good form for back and forth as we listen and hear. Thank you for the opportunity. Give us wisdom. Give us grace. In your son's name, amen.
You join me in the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Honor the Texas flag. I pledge allegiance to the Texas, one state, under God, one. Thank you all very much. Okay. Thanks for everybody being here tonight. The PNC consists of volunteers appointed by the City Council. We coordinate with city staff, owners, developers, and agents, and residents to provide council with independent, objective, and coordinated evaluations and recommendations on planning and zoning issues in the context of state statutes, local ordinances, and the city's land use and comprehensive plans. Except for preliminary plats, all votes are recommendations and are forwarded to the council for decision. Secretary, please note that all commissioners are present. We also have Alderman Shine and Alderman Hallmark here as well. Okay, so we definitely have a quorum. If everybody can turn off your cell phones or pagers, whatever you got out there that makes noise, please turn that off. This is going to take long. First order of business is going to be the approval of minutes from the regular meeting held on January 30th, 2019. Motion here from Commissioner Parker. And do I have a second?
Second.
Okay, Commissioner Walker. Any discussion, commissioners? Nope. All in favor, signify by raising your hand, please. All right. 9-0. And there. Okay. Report of City Council action from February 12th, 2019 meeting. Mr. Mullis for the city.
Yes, so two items from last month's agenda moved forward to the city council. The first one was Z1902, which was the rezoning of an R1M to an R2 in the Wildwood subdivision. You recommended approval 9-0, and the council approved it 5-0. The second one was Z1904, which was the rezoning from R1 to R1R on the property on FM 2410. You recommended approval 9-0, and the council approved it 5-0.
Commissioners, any questions? Okay. Sir, do we have any affidavits?
No, we've not received any conflict of interest affidavits.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Mullis.
Okay, next on the agenda is the economic development report for January. And actually, it's supposed to be February. Courtney's not here, so you can blame me for that one. The February development activity report. So in the month of February, three commercial permits, two commercial and one remodel were issued, but we're counting them as commercial development. 670 Ninth Way is the church's chicken, valued at $490,000. 980 East Ninth Way is the physical It is the fill-out of that third suite where the minor emergency is. Came in valued at $200,000. It's going to be a physical therapy solutions. And finally, a remodel of Seton to put four classrooms in to the existing hospital shell space valued at $18,000. So to date, we've issued a total of 5 commercial permits, 4 for new commercial, 1 for the remodel, totaling $44,938,325, knowing that $44 million of that in change is for the middle school, so it's kind of skewing our numbers. All that being said, almost $1 million in other commercial development this year for February is pretty good.
Fantastic.
We're on track. Residential development, we issued 9 permits for single-family residential construction, 4 in Cedarbrook Ridge, which is that new subdivision being built just south of the Catholic Church, 4 in the Ridge, and 1 in Sutton Place. And so we also issued 2 permits for 2-family residential construction in the Wildwood subdivision. So 2 duplexes are going in there. So to date, we've issued 22 residential permits, 20 single-family, 2 2-family permits, and we haven't issued any multi-family permits. I was not able to calculate the population change for the month of February, but I do have for the month of January, the estimate being 30,230. I will make this comment that the number of active residential water accounts increased from December to January by over 100, but our calculated population went down. And the reason why is because the latest census estimate puts our number of people per occupied units at 2.96, and it used to be 3.03. So the census has made some minor changes to that. And so basically how we calculate population is we look at how many active residential accounts we have, multiply it by that number, average number per occupied unit. And so going down, even though we had more water accounts, it did reduce our population estimate based on that. So it's kind of a moving target. It'll change again in the 2020 census, but at least that number will be a lot firmer. This is just an estimate, but since it's issued by the U.S. Census, we tend to follow that more than our own guess at that point. So, you know, when you see the economic development report for next month, you'll see that the population dropped, and that's why. Any questions?
That's it. Thank you very much, sir. Okay. Public hearing. On our public hearings here tonight, we have D19-06, conduct a public hearing to discuss and consider recommending an ordinance to change zoning designation from R1, one-family dwelling district, to R2, two-family dwelling district, on property described as Lot 12A, Lot 8, the replat of Lots 12 to 14, Lot 8, Wildwood Acres, Harbor Heights, Bell County, Texas, according to the plat of records of Cabinet B, slide 76-A, plat records of Bell County, Texas, and a 2-foot adjacent strip in the south, generally located at 926 Maplewood Drive, Harbor Heights, Bell County, Texas. Mr. Moles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. What you're seeing here is, again, the continued redevelopment of the Wildwood subdivision, moving away from typically manufactured homes to duplexes. The applicant in this case is asking to rezone the property from R1 to R2 at 926 Maplewood Drive, and as you can see from the aerial photography there, that lot is actually several lots that were merged together. And so their goal is to rezone the property to R2 to allow duplexes, and then go back and replat the property to properly be able to get a return on investment as far as placing multiple duplexes on that site. If you look across the street, it looks like they could easily fit 3 duplexes on that property, even with our current intensity of use requirements. So again, it's all consistent with what goes on in that neighborhood. So that's the aerial photograph showing the area. This is a photo showing the property in question. There's a structure on part of it, and then the rest of it is an open lot. And as you can see, the existing land use says that it's a double-wide manufactured home, and it is surrounded by a true mixture of home types. This area is one of our true mixed-use residential areas. You'll see everything from manufactured homes to duplexes to stick-built single-family homes all within, you know, 4 houses of each other. So this is a true mixed-use environment. The zoning for the property is currently R1. It is surrounded by R1 zonings and R1M, which are the single-family manufactured home dwelling districts. But it also has duplex zoning, across the street and immediately adjacent to it. So again, the proposed rezoning would match the existing zoning in the area, would not likely negatively impact the properties. The future land use map calls for medium density residential. Per the 2007 comprehensive plan, medium density residential includes duplexes, so the requested change of zoning would be in harmony, use the term from earlier, with the comprehensive plan and the future land use map. So again, staff doesn't see any potential problems with allowing the rezoning as requested.
Would that be architectural harmony?
Hopefully. Finally, staff sent out 44 notification letters to properties within the 400-foot notification buffer that we generate for rezoning. We received two letters recommending approval. However, one of those property owners owns multiple properties, which is why you see all of the bright green on there. We did not receive any notification letters recommending denial. So that notwithstanding, staff does recommend approval of this rezoning request. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and a representative of the applicant is here as well. Thank you.
All right, commissioners, do you have any questions for Mr. Mullis?
Does anybody live in that blue drive?
You know, I actually don't know if it's occupied or not. We'll have to ask the applicant's representative.
It's not occupied, sir. I'm the representative. It's not occupied.
Okay.
Commissioners, is there any other questions, Mr. Mullis?
No.
All right, sir. Please have a seat there, Mr. Mullis. Okay, who's here representing this request? You are, sir?
Yes.
Can you please come up here to the podium and state your name and your address, please, sir?
Yes, sir. My name is Wayne Key, Jr., and my address is 3004 Veterans Avenue, Copperscope, Texas, 76522.
Very good, sir. And please tell us what your plan is here. What's your plan?
The plan is to put two duplex buildings there, I guess a multifamily. Homes, and eventually put a third one in there if we can. So.
Okay. Well, it looks like it's possible there. Commissioner Watford, does somebody living in the property now?
No, sir. Nobody's living there now. It's vacant right now.
How long has the property been vacant?
About 6 months.
Okay. And how long have you owned it?
We've owned it since it's probably been a little bit over 20 years.
Oh, for a while. Good. Okay. All right, sir. All right, commissioners, do you have any questions here, Mr. Keith? Please have a seat, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, at this time, I'm going to open up the public hearing. Is there anyone here who would like to speak in reference to this agenda item? Is there anyone that would like to speak in reference to this agenda item? Okay. Public hearing there. The applicant, there's no reason for rebuttal. Okay, commissioners, it's back to us. We've seen this before. I need a motion at this time.
I move that we approve as presented.
Very good. Commissioner Parker, do I have a second?
Second.
Yeah, Commissioner Anderson seconds. Okay, any discussion, commissioners? Okay, all in favor, please signify, raise your hands. All right, that is 9-0. It's good, that passes. Okay, next. D19-07, conduct a public hearing to discuss and consider recommending an ordinance to change the zoning designation from R1 One Family Dwelling District to B3 Local Business District and property described as Lots 8 and 9, Block B, Kern Valley, First Extension, according to plat of record in Cabinet A, Slide 229-C, plat records of Bell County, Texas, generally located at 514 and 516 Floor Road, Harper Heights, Bell County, Texas. Mr. Mullis.
Thank you. The applicant is here today again to request a commercial zoning on what has historically been a residential property. However, this property does immediately abut commercial property within the city. As you can see from the location map, it is two lots that are occupied by one property, so it's one house that's sitting on two lots. The applicant has purchased this property and wishes to rezone it for a commercial use. This is the view from the street. You can see there is a manufactured home on the property and then a large vacant portion that was just the yard for that manufactured home. The property is currently a single-wide manufactured home. It is surrounded by what we call public semi-public to the north, which would be the animal adoption center and the fire station to the north. We've got single-family residences. We have vacant lots. and we have commercial to the south. So this is a mixed-use area for the city. The applicant's request to rezone to commercial would not necessarily negatively impact that area because there's already commercial and non-residential uses in the immediate vicinity of this property. The zoning for the property is R1, and it is surrounded by R1 properties, but it does have B3 to the south and B4, and then M1 to the east, which is our industrial zoning district, and the highest, we do have an M2, but there are no M2 zone properties, so that is the highest intense in use in the city. You know, theoretically, you know, all kinds of things that come in as the M1 right immediately adjacent to this property. Future land use map calls for commercial for this property and its neighboring properties. So the applicant's request is in sync with the future land use map and the comprehensive plan. I guess the idea is at some point this area will convert to commercial, looking at the fact that there is an arterial of Indian Trail to the west and an arterial of Lookout Bridge to the east. It kind of makes sense that this would become or evolve into a commercial corridor in the future. So the applicant's request is in line with that future plan. That being said, staff sent out notifications to the 8 properties within the 400-foot buffer, excluding the City of Harker Heights property at the Animal Adoption Center, and we have received no responses recommending approval or denial. So staff does recommend approval of this rezoning request, and I'd be happy to answer any questions as would any of the representatives from the applicant.
Commissioners?
I just have one. You don't expect anything to be built on the right side of that due to that tributary, right? That's pretty deep.
That's correct. What you're looking at on the map is this right here is technically right-of-way that the city has. I presume there were some development plans in the future that might have called for a road to come this way. So this is city right-of-way. And then once you go to the east of that, you have a fairly deep creek with some terrain issues, and then on the other side is the industrial property. So yes, we don't anticipate any development here because of the terrain and the creek.
Although that could be built up, there could be a lot of work done. That area there, eventually, especially with being on I-14, the old Kern place.
And that's correct. That's part of why the future land use map didn't necessarily call that out as a green space, for instance, because you know, if there is incentive, you know, property can be developed. It just depends on how badly you want to do it.
But would that be a 100-year area?
I don't believe it's in the floodplain. It's not identified as in the floodplain. So it
wow.
It's
got signs all around it for the water and everything.
Yeah, there's a sewer line going through there.
But they're in there.
All right, commissioners, any other questions, Mr. Mullis? Thank you, sir. Okay, who's here representing this request? Sir, could you state your name and your address, please?
Sir. My name is Jack Tarver. I'm an attorney in Temple, Texas. I represent the estate of Edna Wolfram, who is deceased, obviously, and was the owner of this property. Incidentally, my home address is 3707 Buffalo Trail, Temple, Texas. I represent Joe Bartek, who is the independent executor of the estate of Ms. Wolfram, again, the owner of the property. This property has not been occupied. They've one residence owned it since she died some months ago. It's a natural for commercial development. The reason why we've made this request is that the HEB has shown an interest in purchasing this property for commercial use, and we have an interest in selling to the HEB. As a matter of fact, they have representatives here today from their real estate department, Jerry O'Brien and Kathy Strimple. They're here with us, with me. So I'll answer any questions that you might have. And also we have Mark Johnson with Stantec, who is an engineer. And there are almost no questions that cannot be answered that you will have. Again, this appears to be a good move for them, for the estate, and for Harker Heights.
Well, I've got a real big question for you, Mr. Tarver.
Yes, sir.
So what you're saying is we have a chance of getting a larger HEB?
No, before we have a chance, don't we wish? But and maybe one of these days. But at this point in time, there is a need for the property. It could be traffic control, parking, whatever. And so it's a good investment for HEB and therefore probably for Park Heights and its citizens, as well as the estate.
I agree, sir.
All right.
All right, commissioners, any questions, Mr. Tarver?
Sir, are y'all planning on moving that trailer that's up in there that she was living in?
Right now, the estate has no plan to move the trailer. If HEB does choose to purchase his property, they can answer that question.
Okay, you can state your name and address, sir.
Sure,
absolutely. Jared O'Brien, 1911 Madison Avenue, Austin, Texas. So the purpose of the land is a couple things, really. A reservation of land for eventually expansion or a larger store if we need it down the line. We have no plans in the immediate term. So, and also, as you guys probably know, it's a very parking-constrained store. So primarily what we need it for in the short term is expansion of our employee parking.
My wife does that deal where she calls them or emails it or...
The curbside, absolutely.
And boom, next thing I know, I'm going to load groceries at some stranger's car. But it works out pretty good for us.
Yeah, very good.
But go ahead, I'm sorry, sir.
And you guys asked if we're going to move the trailer. The answer is likely yes.
Oh,
okay. Any other questions?
This man.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. Please have a seat. Okay. Is there anyone else here that would like to, is there anyone else here would like to speak and reference this item? Is there anyone else? Yes, sir. Please come forward. Take your name and your address.
Stephen Barnes, 508 Plour Road. Was just interested in if there's going to be any noise abatement wall or if the existing chain link fence will be moved. Is it exactly on the property line? Is it moved at all?
Okay, we'll know that. Joseph, what exactly are we looking at there?
There is a requirement that a fence be erected between commercial and residential property. In this part of the city, the limitation is to a privacy fence. We can't require a masonry wall. I want to go back and look at maybe the street view and see if that's something that... And it looks like there's a lot of trees on the property, so depending on how they develop that property, that may or may not...
Hold it for 1 second. Sir, you can come back up here one more time. Now, you live at 508, is that correct?
That is correct. My wife filed for deed for 512.
Oh, so you have your wife has 512, you have 508?
I'm renting 508, but my wife holds the deed for the empty lot in 512.
Okay, all right. So you don't own 508, you just rent there, and then you own 512, your wife. So, all right. So I say the proximity here, I mean, you're already at 508 and 512, you're right there in the building, but I just want to confirm that. Thank you, sir. I'm sorry, Joseph, go ahead.
But yes, we would, our code of ordinances require that if there was any development on that property, we might require a privacy fence. In this case, we couldn't retroactively have HEB put one along their existing property line, but there might be a requirement for one here.
Okay.
And that would just be based on the determination of what type of development goes in there.
Okay. If it was just a parking lot?
We would probably still require that because you're going to have a lot of light trespass. And if we do have not only a requirement for the fence, but also a requirement to prohibit light trespass.
Now, would they have to do anything there at this point until they actually start developing it?
No, only when they develop it.
Okay, very good. All right, commissioners, any questions of Mr. Mullins about what we talked about? No? Thank you, sir. Okay, is there anyone else here that would like to speak in reference to this item? Okay, I'm going to close that out right there. Public hearing is now closed. It is back to us, commissioners. I need a motion at this time.
I move that we approve as presented.
Okay, Commissioner Parker. And do I have a second?
Second.
Commissioner Robinson. Very good. Any discussion, commissioners? Okay, all in favor, please signify and raise your hand. That's 9-0, unanimous right there. Congratulations. And I failed to tell you, sir, Mr. Key, right?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations on yours. Still has to go to the city council, of course. Congratulations. Okay, next item is Z19-01. We've got the public hearing to discuss and consider recommending an ordinance granting a conditional use permit, CUP, to allow an accessory dwelling unit on property described as part of Block 8 and all of Lot 9 and Lot 10, Lot 4, Hidden Valley Estates, in addition to in Bell County, Texas, recorded in Cabinet A, Slide 212-A, Plat Records of Bell County, Texas, generally located at 2223 Fuller Lane, Harper Heights, Bell County, Texas. Mr. Mullis.
Thank you. As you'll notice, this is old business. This is the resumption of the table case from last week. However, because we do have people in the audience that weren't here last week, I'll give an abbreviated presentation just to refresh everybody. The applicant is here today to request a CUP to allow them to occupy a camper on their property while they remodel the interior, possibly the exterior of their home. The applicant is currently residing at 2223 Fuller Lane, and the camper trailer is also on that property. As you can see from this photo taken today, the trailer is in the driveway in the front. The applicant had to move it from the initial proposed placement because it partially encroached the Corps of Engineers property, and that became very apparent when they put the fire break through. And I was told that the eastern portion of the applicant's property is where their septic field is, so that would not be in the appropriate place as well. Where the camper's located now, staff feels is an appropriate area. It's screened by trees. She's put some skirting along the bottom to kind of improve the aesthetics of it. So we'll talk to the applicant about what her plans are for where she wants to keep it while she's working. But for now, this is a more than adequate location. I frankly passed it when I went by to take the photo today because it was so well hidden by the trees, and I was looking for the big blue structure jutting out from the side. So I think that's a pretty good sign there. The existing land use is single family residence, and the request by the applicant is to maintain the use as a single family residence. So again, their request is not necessarily contrary to the existing uses in the area. To the south is the Army Corps of Engineer property, and immediately to her east are vacant properties that are also owned by the applicant. A couple of those are to the west, and to the north are single family residences. The zoning for the area is single family residence, and again, the applicant is asking that this be maintained as a single family residence, but that they be allowed to temporarily reside in that that camper during the course of the remodel. So the applicant is not asking for a zoning that is contrary to the existing zoning of the area, just asking for circumstances to be changed to allow the occupancy of that camper.
But after that, it was going to be a deal where somebody else could live in
it
or something?
No, the applicant submitted a revised statement of intent where that was removed, so it will not be an accessory dwelling. But it is a camper. It's registered as a camper, and so therefore is allowed to be parked even now in the grass if they wanted to, but it's allowed to be on their property.
Okay. And the city is able to keep track of this with the manpower we have right now?
Yes.
Okay,
future land use map calls for a single family residential. Again, the occupant is asking for, dwelling, to be able to dwell in a camper, but they're not going to be living in the home, so technically it's still a single family, but more importantly, there is the temporal aspect of it. They're only asking for a year's time to do that remodel, so we feel that that being the case, it's not disharmonious to the future land use map and the comprehensive plan, that the use of the property is remaining the same. Yes, sir.
The only question we had last time that we couldn't get answered was, does this have a bathroom and a shower?
And the applicant will answer that question at the conclusion of my presentation. Notification was sent out to all the properties within 400 feet. We did receive 4 recommending approval and none recommending denial. I was actually received a phone call from one of those applicants, or one of the persons today, asking if they needed to be here, and I told them since they put a statement they didn't have to, but it's very strongly approved by Mr. Krieger, who you got the letter from that. So I just wanted to point out that he did call again today. He wanted me to mention that. That being said, staff does, I believe staff has no recommendations simply because this is kind of a new situation for us. It's not that we're kind of tacitly recommending denial. It's frankly we don't have anything in our code to deal with this. It's why it's a conditional use permit. So because of that, staff has no recommendation. However, I will point out that we've gotten no recommendations for denial from the public, but we'll see what happens in the public hearing aspect of this. This concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and the applicant is here to be able to answer any as well.
Commissioners, any questions? Mr. Collins?
Thank you, sir.
Okay, who's here representing this request? Man, if you can come up here and state your name and your address, please.
Sure. My name is Tara Ortiz. I live at 2223 Fuller Lane, Parker Heights, Texas.
Okay. Are you okay, Tiffany? All right, good. Yes, ma'am. Please continue. Tell us about your little... did you have that made, or you bought that somewhere?
I had it constructed down in Austin.
Is it like one of those tiny houses?
Yeah, tiny house on wheels.
But you're not a tiny person.
I'm not a tiny person.
Please continue.
So, the plan for right now is to finish renovating the main structure on that property, and then actually move my mother and my grandmother to that property, and then take that tiny house or RV to a different location afterwards. It's just easier for me to work on the house while I'm on site, and because I work a lot, I don't want to have to be driving back and forth between some accessory site and the primary dwelling.
How long have you had the house there?
I bought it back in September of last year.
And it needed work then, or what?
It did. Most of the stuff is just cosmetic. It's something that I enjoy doing, so I plan to do it myself. If there is a need to do it more rapidly, I suppose it could pay somebody to do it, but you know, it's kind of like a hobby for me, so okay. I just thought I'd take the, you know, roughly a year to get it in the good condition. And
so 1 year you're going to have a house finished out, and then the little tiny house thing would be somewhere else?
Yep, then I'd move it somewhere else.
Is there, Commissioner, you had a question about the bathroom and such?
Yeah, there was a question last time, and no one could give a, well, the answer was there was not, but we couldn't confirm that.
Sure, so there is a bathroom in there. I was not using the bathroom in the RV previously. I would go into the main structure to do all the, you know, showering and going to the bathroom and all that stuff. Since I had to move it because the Corps of Engineers is building that fence in the backyard, I've just tied it into the septic, so now I don't need to go into their house, although I certainly still could.
Yeah. It's from the front yard, it's tied into the septic?
Yeah, so let's see.
Probably where it's on the driveway.
Yeah, where it's on the driveway. So just on
the... Oh, you see right there the cap?
Yeah, you can see the caps there. So it's
on the back, yeah. Right,
it's close to where the tanks are. The spray fields are farther to... I mean, in the photo, it's to the left. I don't know what direction that is.
Well, it looks like you have a clean out right here.
East. There's a clean out on the right.
Yeah, right there.
Oh, that white thing there?
No,
that's the main water shut-off valve.
Ah, okay. Sometimes they're in the okay.
So how do you have power to that?
There is just a plug.
So it's plugged into the house.
Okay. So what year is the little tiny house thing?
Let's see. I had it built in 2017.
Okay. All right.
So it wouldn't be possible to live in the house while you redo it?
It would. It would be a little bit frustrating just given the amount of dust and other piles of, you know, things that are going to be in and out of the house. So I think it's just easier because, you know, the
that
smaller house...
That needs to be a lot of money on the little tiny house. I got to tell you, the other day when this came through here, I did not like it. I don't want one of those in my yard.
Sure.
I don't want one in my neighbor's yard. I don't want one over there. But talking with you here tonight, and also with you having it there just for the year or less, and then no one being him not being there after that, I can look at this entirely different. So tell us more. Or if you've got it all there, that's good.
The other thing that came up last time. Were you planning on moving your mom and your grandma in there while you're doing the construction?
No, they actually live in North Carolina, so once construction is finished, then I'll bring them from there.
Oh, okay. All right.
Commissioners, any other questions? All right. Well, thank you for your service, first of all. And please have a seat, young lady, and we'll see what we do here. Okay, at this time, I'm going to open up the public hearing. is there anyone here that would like to speak in reference to this agenda item? Is there anyone here that would like to speak in reference to this agenda item? Okay. Close out the public hearing, and now it's back to us commissioners. We need a motion at this time, and then...
I'm moving that way to first, and you're going to start
this. Commissioner Parker has used his sixth motion tonight. He's allowed. That's cool. All right. Second. Okay, Commissioner Watford is second. So again, we have Commissioner Parker motioning, and we have a second from Commissioner Watford. Any discussion?
I have one question. Is that for granting it for the year? Are we putting a time frame on it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it starts tonight after the approval, correct?
Well, after the city council. After the city council.
Yeah, okay. If they approve it, the city council.
If they, you're a recommending body, you're recommending to the council that they approve it, and then they will make the decision, and then that will start the clock. Is there a time? Do we have a 1 year in there anywhere? In the,
I don't think
there is. That was 12 months.
So. Yeah, it was in the conditions.
Okay.
All right, good. All right.
Okay.
Okay, yes, sir.
Just as part of the discussion, I know there's nothing in the ordinance that really says you can do this per se. So it's like, are we setting a precedent? But in this case, it's like, I don't see where there's going to be a lot of people trying to do this and abusing that type of CUP. In this case, it's one person trying to do this, and I can understand it. So. That's right.
I mean, like the other day, I was totally against this. I said it, totally against it. But now, I think the 1 year thing, I can deal with that. So.
And we don't have anybody complaining about it.
Yeah, we have people here, right. Multiple people liking it, saying it's okay with them. So that's okay with me.
And I'll point out, we did notify twice. So we notified in January, and then when it got tabled, we re-notified. That's why Mr. Krieger sent me another letter. So we have two opportunities to reply to this.
Okay, good. All right, commissioners, is there any other discussion? Nope. Okay, then here we go. All in favor, please signify by raising your hand. All right, we have 9-0. That passes. Congratulations, gentlemen. Again, thank you for your service. That's how it is for citizens to be heard. Are there any citizens who wish to speak tonight? Very good. The next item is going to be reports from P&B commissioners, alternates. Are there any commissioners or alternates who wish to speak tonight? Nope. Are there any staff comments? I've already got a comment.
Let me quick. I just want to publicly acknowledge Chair Robison. He presented the end of year summary for 2018 to the City Council last night. Did a wonderful job, represented this body very well, and spoke very highly of all of you. And I just wanted to publicly thank you for your service and for doing such a great job last night.
Thank you very much. You know, couldn't do it without these guys right here and girls. So, thank you very much. Okay, hearing nothing further, let's see if I have the time right here. During this regular meeting of the P&Z at 7:11 p.m. That's part of the 7:13. This is different from that. So, 7:13 p.m.
Good evening.
We're done.